To the House of Assembly chamber this evening. The microphone's come on, so you should be able to hear me. I might say just at the outset, having occupied this chair for a short time some years ago, I just say to you it's highly unusual in the normal course for the occupant of this chair to be addressing the chamber on their feet. That's a sign something's really quite serious. Not on this occasion. Indeed, a former speaker, Michael Atkinson emphasises the point, but I will just take my feet to welcome you all here to the House of Assembly for this very special ASPG occasion. They're always interesting, and I might say as an ad at the outset, we'll soon have the honour of having Anthony Green back to speak to the ASPG about an election that just occurred on the weekend. So keep an eye on the ASPG and join it, and let this not be your one and only occasion to be coming along to the ASPG. But tonight we're in for a special treat, and I'll say a bit more about that briefly in a moment. My name is Josh Teague. I'm a member of this place and represent the Adelaide Hills electorate of Hyson. I acknowledge the country to begin with. I acknowledge the traditional owners, custodians of this Kaurna land on which we're meeting, and I pay my respects to the elders past, present, as well as emerging leaders, and I extend my respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who might be here with us today. It was one of the honours of my time as Speaker, in fact, to cause the flying of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander flags, along with the state and national flags, in the chamber. Just a word about the ASPG, the Australian Australasian Study of Parliament group is one well familiar to members and those who work in this place. It's a non-partisan body, with chapters in each state and territory focused on encouraging research, writing and teaching and discussion about parliamentary institutions. The SA chapter, of which I'm the president, tends to hold about three events each year, and tonight is a free event as part of History Month. So let's bring that together, and I recognise in particular Greg Mackey has joined us along with so many who've made a significant contribution to History Month. You're welcome, as I say, to join ASPG and to come along to future seminars and events. They generally include supper and refreshments, and if you'd like to be included on a mailing list, then make sure to see one of us about the contact details about that. There's no filming or flash photography in the House of Assembly chamber tonight. The event will be recorded but not live streamed, and so the microphones will be in use, and there will be a record of tonight's occasion, therefore, but no filming or flash photography. And if you require a bathroom, I recommend that you make your way to the door directly at this end. You'll be directed by staff who can help you to find the most convenient bathroom. It's one of the few criticisms of the architects of this building that even back in 1890 there were too few and far between bathrooms. So I won't start to give you directions, except seek help at that end if you need it. And if there's an emergency, then also follow the staff who will be able to direct you in the right way. I'm going to hand over to David Bevan in a moment to give a more fulsome introduction. David Bevan will be well known to all of you as a long-standing ABC morning radio host, but also expert on all things, particularly South Australian state politics. He'll be moderating tonight's hopefully lively, but not a too combative review of the 2002 state election. He'll give a more fulsome introduction to two people who will already be very familiar to you. Firstly, the Honourable Mike Rann AC, CNZM, former Premier from 2002 to 2011, and another former Premier, the Honourable Rob Kerrin. With that, I'll hand it over to you, David Bevan. Thank you all. I hope you enjoy this evening.
For me, this is my second ASPG function. A few months ago, I was asked to moderate a retrospective on the 1993 election campaign with former Premier Lynn Arnold and Dean Brown. For those of you who missed it, this is the sequel. It's not so much Godfather Part 2, it's more like The Empire Strikes Back. At times, it feels like an episode of Game of Thrones. I believe, this is a personal opinion, we'll open it up for questions later on. I'll be very interested to see what Rob and Mike think of this, but I think that decade leading up to the 2002 election was the most tumultuous in state politics in living memory. Now, some people might say, well, you were just a boy for the Dunstan decade, David. You need a lesson. But I think for sheer bastardry, you can't go past the 10 years up to 2002. And to set the scene for you, for those of you who missed that decade, 1993, Labor was reduced to just 10 seats after the state bank debacle. Within 3 years, there's a late night coup, and don't we all remember that night, which sees Liberal Premier Dean Brown replaced by John Olsen. A year later, Olsen is forced into minority government at the 97 election. The Liberals lose 13 seats. Are you all paying attention? There will be questions later on. Mike Rann and the Labor team, they win 10. Significantly, though, independents are starting to appear. Carlene Mayward for the National Party in the Riverland, and in the southeast, Rory McKeown and Mitch Williams. All right? Now, it's not all going Mike Rann's way, because in that second term, because Olsen is able to form a minority government, two Labor heavyweights, Terry Cameron and Trevor Crothers, they have to leave the Labor Party after supporting John Olsen's privatisation of the state's biggest asset, ETSA. Olsen has broken a promise. He's sold this asset, but he has had a coup. He's able to get it through the parliament. He's now flushed with money. He can pay down debt, but the bastardry returns. Williams has returned to the Liberal Party, but Bob Such and Peter Lewis, they leave. And the turmoil continues as the moderate Liberals carry out their continued grudge against Olsen for taking the leadership. Olsen will eventually have to resign over what was known as the Motorola affair. Does anybody remember it? Yes? Anybody understand it? A few of you, yeah. I spent far too much of my life getting my head around the Motorola affair. But it cost a Premier. It was different times, but it was also a testimony over what can be done when you have a minority government. Rob Kerrin is now Premier because Olsen has to go. It's just 3 months out from the election campaign. Rob Kerrin, good evening to you.
Did you ever
think that just 3 months out from an election campaign, you were going to be Premier?
No. I could leave it in one word, really, but no, they were tumultuous times, there's no doubt about that. I only came in 93, so was part of that really bulky government party there for 4 years, and then Mike well and truly took a heap of seats back off us in 97. But yeah, no, there are interesting times in the parliament, interesting times in the Liberal Party.
But But what was it like in the party? I mean,
was there a sense of shock? Olsen is gone. You're the boss. What on earth are we going to do? We've only got 3 months before the election.
Yeah, we were riding pretty low at the time because we'd also lost a couple of ministers to resignation. So we were... it wasn't the happiest time for us, but you've got an election coming up, so you've just got to get everyone to pull together, which they pretty well did. Like, I think the 3 or 4 months or whatever it was, I was really happy with the way the guys came together after a lot of time, you know, sort of unhappy times, if you know what I mean. Like, happy times are when you're in government normally, but it was a bit of a rocky road for a government party, and particularly the losses in 97, where we lost a lot of colleagues and went to minority government, was that set the scene. And I think the main thing for us, we didn't get absolutely wiped out in 2002.
That's a good day.
Yeah, well, the way that, you know, the way that things were happening, the polls, I think we were about 39% or something at that stage. So. But thankfully everyone pulled together, and over that few months we at least became competitive in the election.
Mike Rann, did you think maybe we were too successful in toppling Olsen? You were prepared to fight him. You had his measure. And now you've got to fight this guy.
Yeah, well, I think many people would have seen the toppling of John Olsen as a monumental own goal for us. I mean, it had come about through a series of questions which had been asked, I think, several years before, and they kind of kept travelling. There'd been various inquiries. But Rob is right. Our polling showed us on 60%. Just, I think that was in August. There was a series of events also... extraneous events. There was 9/11, which totally consumed the world, as well as, and then there was John Howard called an election and won. There was the Tampa incident. There was a whole series of things that happened. And then before the federal election, shortly afterwards, Rob becomes the Premier, and Rob completely obliterated our lead. I mean, literally overnight, we went from, or over the next couple of weeks, we went from a 60%, 60-40, and then I remember the pollster, who also had a very colourful turn of phrase, too colourful for me to repeat tonight, but basically said they think that there's been an election, there had been, the federal election. They're pleased, and I don't want to disparage anybody tonight, but they're pleased that John Olsen has gone, and they really like the new guy, and they think there's been an election, and they're really happy with the new Premier. And so, essentially, I think the polling showed at one stage 46% for us, from 60 to 46. I think we then got up to about 40, 48. So, you know, the truth is that Rob was the most. I faced six Liberal leaders because I was the leader of the Labor Party. No wonder I'm starting to go grey. So in my 17 years and 1 month as Labor leader, I faced six Liberal leaders and I think 8 or 9 deputy leaders. The hardest one to beat was Rob.
Why?
Because people liked him. And why did they like him? Because he's a nice guy. And is that true? Yes. I mean, I can honestly say this tonight, and I want to say it, that Rob and I have never had a cross word with each other. When I know that whenever we made an agreement, both of us stuck with it. And, you know, you have to go through election campaigns and debates with Ray Martin and various other things. But so, you know, so we basically had gone from, I've got some figures here, a 9.4% swing to us in 97, a 7.7% swing to us in 2006, but a 0.58% swing in 2002. And I know that the factions, and I'm pleased that Cardinal Atkinson here is with us. I love that red hat. I just wondered what was going on and why he wasn't at the conclave. But anyway, the fact of the matter is that, you know, I was essentially given 2 terms to get back into government. So I knew absolutely that if I didn't get elected in 2002, then I was going to be applying for a job at the ABC.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, and we'll come to that in a moment, because there are lots of stories, they just become embedded in the folklore that Don Farrell had given you. 2 terms, that was it. So we'll come to that in a moment. But just before we leave that decade, for people who didn't live through it, and it was the Wild West, I've actually heard a recording of a senior Liberal coaching you on how to question John Olson when he was Premier. That's how bad it was.
Well, I mean, it's actually in the 96 and 97, so before Dean Brown was toppled and after, there was absolutely no doubt there were divisions in the Liberal Party, and we were getting leaks all the time. We got leaks to the point where people would not, you know, there were other people on hold waiting to leak to us, because that actually did happen.
Those that leaks, actually happened?
That actually happened, and all of those leaks stopped when Rob became Premier, all of them. So they blocked in, and it was, you know, it wasn't just existential, it was genuine.
Yeah. But that finishes when Rob Keren takes over. I wonder, because, well, he's a neutral candidate, he's a nice guy, everybody likes Rob, but also there's that discipline of only being 3 months out from an election. We're going to lose our seats if we don't get our act together. But you touched on the promise that had been given to you. Is that factual? And was it Don Farrell who said to you way back in 94 when you took the Labor leadership, the opposition leader's job, Mike, I'll give you 2 terms. If you can't do it, then we'll find someone else.
I don't think it was explicit. It was understood. And it was basically, you've got 2 terms to get us back, and we want to see you get halfway there at the halfway mark. And of course, we got 95% of the way there at the halfway mark. And then when you're being told you're on 60%, one day I think I was told 61%, there was a kind of an expectation that there was a momentum towards government, but a momentum that was substantially stalled when John Olson left.
But was it also that the issues kind of cancelled each other out? Because the campaign was going to be fought on privatisation, because Olson had broken his promise over the sale of ETSA, but it had got through, and the Liberals now had a big bundle of cash to spend, and they were going to cut debt, and the man who was responsible for that has paid the price. He's gone. Likewise, the issue of Liberal disunity. So the things you were going to camp, you must have had a whole campaign built around one person.
It was already in the can. We basically, advised by Bruce Hawker, who was, in my view, is the best political strategist I've ever worked with, we'd counted back from when an election, at that stage it wasn't fixed term.
No.
And Rob very cleverly called the election in January when everyone was on holiday. I'm sure that was just purely coincidental. and it was pretty much first half of February, so people were not sort of really focused. So you've got Christmas, you've got people away. It made it very difficult to punch through a message. But the election campaign was going to be privatisation, still was, more money for health and education. We'd had 150 meetings around the state called Labor Listens, where they basically, I asked them, what do you expect of us if we get elected? They wanted to be tougher on law and order, put more money into hospitals and schools, and they also wanted us to make a pledge that there would be no more privatisations.
Okay, so after this campaign, the result is virtually nothing has changed. The two-party preferred swing is less than 1%. Labor picks up 2 more seats, that's Colton
and the seat of Adelaide, but the Conservative vote is still in front, 50.93% to 49.03%. On election night, Mike Rann, what are you thinking? Are you thinking, well, we got close, but in the end, after this tumultuous decade, it was a big fizz?
We were waiting for results to come in from Stewart and also Eastern Hartley, and Norwood had been completely changed in terms of its economic demographics, so we were worried about Vinny picking up Jane and Paul Kiker, but at the same time losing Vinny. So there was a huge effort, and Vinny prevailed, and she later on prevailed massively against the captain of the Crows. But it was pretty much touch and go. So we ended up, so Rob and the Liberals won the two-party preferred, but we had 23 seats, they had 20, and there were these independents. And that's really, you know, where Rob's efforts and my efforts were really probably more intense than even the election campaign, is who is going to decide who is going to be the government. And also, by the way, a number of other things happened, which was the Queen was coming to town,
yep,
and also Bill Clinton was coming to town. So there was a whole lot of things going on, and the media were after John Howard, who was at the airport with Rob and I to welcome the Queen over Kids Overboard, and the Governor General, Archbishop Hollingworth, was also involved in controversy, so, which is why the Queen, during her visit, and I've found her over the years to be wonderfully funny, witty, super smart, talked to us about the weather.
What about Bill Clinton?
Bill Clinton was so tribal, and he had been in Western Australia, and I think he'd been briefed by a close friend of mine, Jeff Gallup, and he put his arm around me and said, "Are you going to get there? Are you going to get there? What's going to happen? I need to know what's going to happen." So I said, "We don't know." And he got up onto the stage and said, Rob was there, but he actually called me Premier Rann. So the first person that ever called me Premier was the former President of the United States.
Rob, what are you doing on election night? Are you thinking, okay, well, it wasn't great, but it could have been a lot worse. We at least won. We've got the moral authority because we won the just over 50% of the two-party preferred. And the people who are going to hold the balance of power, they're all ex-Libs or a National Party MP. That it's going to be tough, but we've got it in the bag. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, well, one of the things that fed into that a bit too was Peter Lewis, actually, I think it was Dean Brown that he rang, because Peter didn't think he could win the seat. He was way behind Barry Featherston on primaries, and he thought he'd lost the seat that night, which proved to not be the case. I can't remember what he got up by in the end, but it wasn't many.
No.
But he got a hell of a lot of preferences, which you wouldn't have expected in that seat, but he did. So Peter went from almost conceding on the night of the election to holding the ultimate balance of power.
Now, for people who
never had the fortune of knowing Peter Lewis, and it was an interesting time. Peter is a one-time Liberal, long-time Liberal, but he had left the party during that last term. He hated John Olsen, didn't he, Rob?
Yeah, he basically, I moved the moved to kick Peter out after he'd gone on the ABC one morning and called John a liar.
Oh.
Now, you've got a member of your party calling the Premier a liar. John was actually in London at the time. So I just didn't think that was something that you could put up with. I rang John and told him what we were going to do, and we went over to Old Parliament House, I think it was, and had a meeting, and
upstairs was it,
yeah. But yes, so so Peter got kicked out basically.
Yeah.
But it wasn't his only, like, there were interviews where he was just, John, he just didn't like John. and he'd go really hard in that area.
But are you assuming on election night they're conservatives? They're going to, there'll be argy-bargy, we're all going to have to get our head around what branch broom rape is, but we'll get there eventually. Is that what you're assuming?
Didn't really assume anything. You needed the whole four. Rory and Carlene were probably a little bit easier to read. Bob Such was probably... We would have been pretty confident with Bob, but Peter, through the fact we kicked him out and a range of other issues that were ongoing, you never really knew with Peter. He could change his mind three times in a day.
Mike Rann, when did the courtship, not of Eddie's father, but of
Peter Lewis, begin?
Well, I'd always... I mean, I believed when I knew that when we didn't have Hartley and we didn't have Stuart, and I pretty much assumed at that stage that all four would go with the Liberals. But as Rob said, you know, that they needed to get all four, I needed to get one. So the first thing we did, I've never revealed this before, but it was a long time ago, but I met in a deserted nightclub with, I think it was called the Fell Fella in Rundle Street East, with Bob Such, and tried to talk him into being speaker. And he was really, he just said that he just couldn't at that stage bring himself to do that. He did say he wanted to see stability, and he said he was getting lots of phone calls to his office in equal proportions about going with Labour and Liberals. So I think, you know, I found Bob in a state where he just basically couldn't make up his mind, which made me think that he would go with Rob. So I thought, okay, went back to the office, and I said, Peter Lewis is the only game in town. We're either going to be in government because of Peter Lewis or not. And there were a number of people who got on well with Peter. One of them was Mick Atkinson. Another one was Randall Ashbourne, who was on my staff, and also really good work by Peter Chataway, who'd been on my staff for years and was on my staff for years. So they kind of went in to see him. And then eventually, when he's elected, finally elected, he's kind of negotiating with both sides. And I'd heard when he came in to see me that he'd spent 5 hours with Dean Brown and I think others, and I was given 5 minutes. And I'm sure you've got other questions, but I'm happy to tell you exactly what happened.
Well, I want to know more about the deserted nightclub. So there's you and Bob. What do you mean deserted nightclub? This is an empty building, is it?
No, it's a restaurant, but there's a nightclub upstairs.
Karaoke upstairs.
Karaoke upstairs.
So it's a karaoke bar.
Karaoke bar. And it was Bob's why didn't he come in? I could have gone to his office or his electoral office. He wanted it to be somewhere.
Okay.
He chose a karaoke bar. Which did. I had a friend from America who worked on a series of American campaigns. He came down with me and he thought this was bizarre.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, there's a lot of bizarre stuff that's going to happen over the next 3 weeks. Yeah. All right. The meeting with Peter Lewis lasts 5 minutes.
Five or six, seven.
What happened?
The first meeting, he had a list of demands that he'd put to the other side and as well. And one of them was he wanted a constitutional convention. I think at first up it was that he wanted sort of deliberative votes, like you could have a referendum on every pretty much it. Citizens initiated referenda. And that's dangerous. You get Proposition 13 and things like that. But anyway, so I said we'd be happy to have a constitutional convention that would look at some of the issues that he was on about, which included reducing the number of MPs, which included about the future of the upper house, whether it was going to be reduced in numbers, changed in what it did, so on. So I said that we would agree to that. He then said, would I declare war on broom rape. Of course, I had no idea what he was talking about.
No.
But But I asked him, and he told me, and I said, yeah, no, we're happy to do that. And then there was something bizarre about a school bus from Wellington to somewhere.
There's a whole lot of local electorate stuff.
And he said that it had been cancelled, and I said it should never have been discontinued. and then we went down, it would have been the same with Rob, we went down this list, and some of it, oh, there was about commercial fishing in the River Murray.
Yeah. Commercial netting in the River Murray.
River Murray, and there were a couple of other things, and none of them were going to, in my view, none of them were anything that was going to be like totally earth-shattering. It wasn't asking us to, you know, do something totally bizarre, although those things came later. And so we were able to say yes to that. I think Rob said yes in the end.
We negotiated on some of them.
But you
the
basically...
The one was mad, like what he wanted. That was what I used to do in life. Control weeds. But so we modified a fair bit, but we still kept the discussions open.
You were basically prepared to give Peter everything that Mike was prepared to give Peter, but the one thing you couldn't give him was the power of one, because you had to get the others, whereas Mike could say, I can give you the power of one, and that's what Peter wanted. Is that fair?
I think that's... There's probably a bit of truth in that,
He did, so I sort of said to him, he said he had to go, and I could not read which way he was going to go. There's all these conspiracy theories that we knew what he was going to do. I didn't know. And then I said, hang on. I said, you've just spent hours and hours and hours with the Libs. And I remember the final words I said to him was that I didn't know about your emotions. I'm not having a go at you about this. Yeah. But I said, they expelled you. They expelled you from the party. I said, so I just want to say this to you. My final word is, do you want to be the despised tail end of a chorus line, or would you like to play a starring role as speaker? He looked at me and he shook me by the hand and said, whatever I decide will not diminish the regard I have for you. Went away, and then we're hearing that he'd been telling people around Parliament that Dean Brown had persuaded him to go with the Libs. Mm-hmm. He's told people in his electorate that he would not possibly put in a Labour government. So I'm getting all of this. Now, admittedly, you know, there was Mick doing things, there was others doing things, Randall and Peter Chataway.
Yeah, there was a final meeting in Mike's office. Kevin Foley was there.
Pat Connell was there, Mike and I, and Randall Ashbourne brought round Peter's lists of demands. And it came to citizens-initiated referendums, and Pat Connell said, we can't cop this. And I took my fountain pen from inside my jacket, gave it to Mike, and he signed straight away.
Well, that was my next question, Mike Rand. Were there people in your caucus, perhaps your shadow cabinet, who opposed the deal?
People were saying to me, some people, not the majority, people were saying to me, look, even if he does back us in, it won't last. It'll last 6 weeks, or it'll last 3 months. He'll end up just, you know, basically sort of destroying the government. So there was a bit of a mood of that. There might have been some personal ambitions as well along the way. But and in my head, by the way, I'd already written my resignation speech. I knew exactly what I was going to say, because I thought the balance of probabilities would be that I would end up being probably lasting a couple more days, and then of course he was going to make he came back in for that meeting where we signed, you guys signed something, it wasn't exclusively for us, and then there was his news conference, and we had I sat in the office with a group of people. Vinnie, Jenny Rankin, Mick, Kevin Foley, Michael Wright, my staff, and I'm trying to follow what was going along here. And it was interesting that I said, and I remember the words, I turned to people and I said, I think we're cactus, which I thought that it was all over. And Michael Wright suddenly said, no, I think he's going, because if you actually read what he said, and I've read what he said subsequently, it is very hard to decipher. Yeah. And then he decided to put Labour in. And I remember what I said to our staff, there's been no triumphalism. We've still got to have, we're not there yet. We haven't been sworn in. And we just we're going to honour our commitments to him. I don't want anybody making any comments about him. Everybody shut up in terms of the media, and let's just see what happens next.
See, I'm wondering what it would have been like to be inside Mike Rand's head at that moment, because you're trying to deal with this renegade former Liberal, now Conservative MP, who has a reputation, and we all had personal experience of Peter. I got along very well with him, but you know, he could be erratic. You've got the other independents. You've got people within your own caucus who wanted to replace you and were prepared to pay the price of four more years in opposition. So you've got sharks swirling around you in your own party, while you're trying to deal with an octopus.
Yeah, that's pretty much right.
Yeah,
and so I saw it as the only game in town was Peter Lewis. In the meantime, though, the next phase was going to be, if we can get sworn in, we then absolutely embrace the other independents, because I did not believe, he lasted 3 years, I did not believe he would last that long. And so we started, and we made Bob Such chair of committees. And then, of course, there was, Rob said, even after Peter Lewis said he was going with us, Rob said he wanted it tested in here, which I totally understood.
Were you basically buying for time, Rob Cairn? You said, look, because Peter Lewis, I think he announced his decision about 3 or 4 days after the election, but you said, no, I'm entitled to test this on the floor of this chamber, and that would give you 3 weeks. Were you basically buying for time?
I took it to the party room. I, probably before the debate in the party room, I was ready to go. But the debate in the party room...
When you mean to go, you mean as in leader, you resigned?
No, willing to concede that, you know. But there was a point of view put that Peter should have to do it in the parliament. And the ones who put that point of view did it pretty well. And there was, Mark, there was pretty much agreement right across the party in the end, I think, for us to see it through, take it to the parliament and get it done properly. And otherwise, we could have just walked away and we would never have really known because of the nature of Peter.
Which also, I have to say, that delay, I think I was thinking to myself, this could all change on the turn of a dime, as they say in America. So we were still talking to independents because we wanted to make sure that, you know, stability in government. So I think it was really smart tactic to put it on the floor of the parliament, in which, by the way, I did not speak. You spoke, and then Mick Atkinson spoke for the opposition.
Yeah. I remember that day sitting just up there, and for me, I mean, there's a lot of cynicism about politics, but there are moments where I think we should all pause and appreciate what has just taken place. And what I saw was a government change hands because one group of people got up and walked to the other side of a room, and another group of people walked to the other side, and then two men met just down there. My memory is that the two of you met in the middle of this room and you shook hands and you wished each other the best, and a government changed hand. A shot wasn't fired, a bomb wasn't thrown,
A group of people decided we will respect the constitutions, the conventions, we'll respect each other, and if we've got a difference, we'll sort it out at the next election or in the chamber at another occasion. To me, it was always a precious moment.
And also when we had to go to Government House, Rob and I walked over together, the pictures that show that. So, I mean, that's the advantage of, you know, you look at what's happening in the United States, thank God we're not at that stage. And, you know, that there is an ability. And one of the things that people don't realise, I mean, Rob and I both had the same experience of being leaders of the opposition. There's no worse job than being leader of the opposition, because if you don't go in hard, you're criticised by your own side as being too soft. If you go in hard, you're a knocker. The number of times people said to me, why can't both sides of politics agree for the good of the state? So we actually did a content analysis of votes in this place and in the upper house, and it was 87% support of the Labor Party for legislation put up by Dean Brown and John Olson over time. In fact, one year it was 89%. So there's, but of course the media aren't interested in, you know, agreement in
Parliament. Don't get me started about the media.
And then, and then, you know, sometimes you'd go out and say, okay, I need to do light and show. We had a big attack on them yesterday. Today we're going to be praising them because we support this initiative. The lights on the cameras all turn off. So, you know, so being an opposition leader, there is no worse job. And I had almost 8 years of it, which is, as I say, why I've prematurely aged.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so the decision is made, Peter Lewis, and basically it was because of the power of one. I think we're agreed on that. That was the major thing. He knew that if he sided with you, he'd be one of four. If he sides with Mike, he's one of one. And that's the psychology of that moment. You immediately begin, Mike Rann, wooing the others. You need a plan B. Yeah. Rob, Karen, my memory is that the Liberal Party immediately started sulking. And that, you know, there was the court case. There was, you know, the constant whinging. You know, we won the two-party preferred. We're not in government. You shouldn't be there. And everybody else had just moved on. To take up Mike Rann's point, a lot of people in South Australia thought that the election had occurred before the election actually occurred. And that shows the level of interest for rank and file people. So the Liberals complaining, it was. Do you look back at that as 4 years that were wasted? I suppose that's the question.
The next 4 years.
Yeah, I think a lot of our people found it really hard. But one of the things that I remember was always in my mind that even if Peter had have gone with us that day, he would have been unstable going forward, unstable, because I just, because of the history with the Liberal Party that he had, at any one decision, you might find him cross the floor. Yeah, you know, like it was not as if satisfying Peter would automatically give us 4 years.
No, and you would always rely on Peter Lewis, whereas Mike Rann could start to look for alternatives. And indeed, I remember Rory McKeown and Carlene Maywood, they rang our station. We were talking to Peter Lewis. He was in our studio. He was explaining why he was doing what he did. And Carlene and Rory rang in, and I said, better put them to air. And they were furious with him for signing with Mike Rann and installing a Labor government. What a total betrayal. Within 2 years, they're members of your cabinet. But you would always have had to have relied on Peter Lewis, whereas Mike Rann did not.
We would have had to be relying on Peter for the 4 years, which was, unless it was a by-election or whatever.
Yeah. And just to reinforce Rob's point, I mean, within a few months, bizarre things started to happen.
Such as?
Well, there was one, and I can't remember the specific issue, but Peter had a news conference and he'd come up with some idea that was not part of the stability pact. It had nothing to do with what we signed up to, but he came up with some idea that was batshit crazy. And he said that unless, this was on a Monday, that unless I met with him and agreed to this, he would bring me and the government down, and he would call a news conference on the Friday to give the government these few days to look at it. So I'd said to everyone, we're going to run, we've got a majority of one, and that one is unstable. We're going to run this government. It's going to be a four-year campaign because I want to build up so many seats that we're going to be in for a long time. And, you know, if you look back, Peter Lewis ensured that Labor was in for 16 years. And I said, but we can't be pulled around by the nose. We're going to govern as if we've got a government of 10, like a majority of 10, not a government of one and that person being. So he basically threatened to pull down the government. I then put out a statement saying that we weren't going to do this and that I wasn't going to meet him about it. It wasn't. So it was like we stood him up. Now, we had been talking to Bob Such. So what happened was that on the Wednesday of that week, I went to the state funeral in the Riverland of the last World War I digger. The governor, Marjorie Jackson Nelson, was going to be there, the federal minister for defence, people from around Australia. On the way to the Riverland, I said to Barry, my driver, I said, look, I would need to have a comfort stop a lot before we go because it's going to be a very, very long ceremony. And so we pulled over to in Main Street of Lake Bonnie, and I walked into the loo there, and there was one person in the loo, which was Peter Lewis. And I did not expect this for a moment. He then said to me, hello, Mr. Premier, I've been trying to talk to you. And I said, I'm not going to be stood over. You said you would guarantee stability in the state. We're not going to put up with this. If you want to bring us down, bring us down. But we're not going to be playing silly buggers for the next 4 years. That was it. Go to the funeral and come back to town, tell the staff. On the Friday, there was a news conference because he'd said he was going to report back to the media. And he was asked whether he was going to bring me down and he said, and bring the government down. He said, no, he'd had a good meeting with me. And we've discussed the matter and that he basically was going to maintain his support. I think it was Mike Smithson said, what? Where did this meeting take place? And he said, in the latrine at Lake Bonnie.
So this is where government... We're here as a retrospective of the 2002 election campaign, but... It seems to me that what occurred there after this tumultuous decade was that politics, it's a reminder of how politics is played out in various levels. You know, it's played out at the macro level with a million people casting their votes, but it's also played out in rundown nightclubs and latrines at Lake Bonnie and meetings where people are expelled and... It carries its own dynamic, but you said once, Mike, you were criticised, saying one of the things that you were branded with, that you were a professional politician. Mm. And I remember your reply was, yes, and you need to be.
Yeah, I said, one of the things I always said, yeah, because some of the people were saying it were from the right, I said, so is John Howard, so is Gough Whitlam. I said, so was Winston Churchill, so was JFK. When you go on a plane, do you really want the pilot to be an amateur? Or when you go and have open heart surgery? I said, I'm a professional politician, but on the other side of the equation, having Rory and Carlene in our government, and we made a promise to them that if we got re-elected with the biggest ever majority in 2006, we would keep them in as long as they wanted to be, and that was redeemable with my resignation. They made us a much better government because they had a rural and regional culture and background and interest and expertise that we didn't have in our grouping, as talented as they were. And you know, I mean, I went to federal meetings on the River Murray during the drought with Howard and Turnbull and all of these officials from the Murray-Darling Commission. Carlene Maywald cleaned up, totally cleaned up. She totally, absolutely knew her stuff. And, you know, and so they made us a better government.
It's getting late, and I want to leave an opportunity to take questions from you, because you might all have your own questions. But just to wrap up, gentlemen, it seems to me that the lessons of 2002 are playing out in 2025. They are lessons which don't have an expiry date to them, and that is party discipline wins elections, division is death, be friendly to independents. Is that a fair comment? I mean, this is not rocket science, but it is an art. Rob, when you look at your own party today in 2025, whether it be the federal election or the state election that is only, it's less than 12 months away, the lessons are the same, aren't they?
Yeah, and I hope they heed them federally, because there's some real lessons out of the last weekend.
Yeah.
Huge lessons.
Such as?
Oh, I think that, one of them is that there's no more votes on the right. And I don't know where those who take us to the right really think any votes are going to come from. You're only going to lose them in the middle. And I think that's one of the big lessons that they've got to learn. There's just no room out there on the right. And others have taken some of that space anyway. But, I think there's some massive lessons for the Federal Party out of the last weekend.
Mike Rann, you're nodding. Shall we open it up for questions?
Yeah. I'm very happy to.
Yeah. Do we have questions? Mark Brindle, the former member for Unley.
Yes, Mark, you're uncharacteristically... And this is for the history books now, because none of us are there. You're uncharacteristically modest, I think. well, it's not always.
Humility I know, is Mike, my middle I name.
Know. That's no, right. It's a wonder you weren't... no, it's all right. You, some months before the election, Randall was very close to you.
Yeah.
And some months before the elections, unremarked, and it was to our failing that it was unremarked, Randall shifted offices. Randall was housed with you down here.
This is Randall Ashbourne.
Randall Ashbourne. Shifted offices, and he shifted office, guess where? Straight opposite Peter Lewis's office. And Randall, who's not here tonight, so I can hopefully speak honestly on his behalf, Randall said he worked assiduously for months on Peter Lewis. I'm not denying anything you said, but I actually think you were much, much cleverer than you're giving yourself credit for, because Lewis promised four times publicly to support the Liberal Party. Dean Brown left Peter Lewis after that 5 hours, and the cabinet was rung and told we're in office. The first we knew, like you knew, was when he did his press conference. So I'd actually ask you to...
Did the courtship of Peter Lewis begin with Randall Ashbourne shifting opposite his office months before?
Well, if it was, then he wasn't telling me, because at that stage, months before, John Olse, we were on 61%. Yeah. Peter Lewis would have been irrelevant, and then we had a federal election, 9/11, all of those things. But Mick would probably know better.
Left to his own devices, Peter Lewis would not have won the State District of Hammond in 2002. Randall Ashbourne imposed a certain discipline on him and edited his election material. And but for Randall, I don't think Peter Lewis would have won that seat.
So a Labor staffer is working on the election material of an independent.
Oh, well, I was too busy with Enfield at the time.
You weren't aware of that, Mike Rann?
No, he didn't tell me. But Randall got himself into a bit of trouble along the way.
He did.
With various things. But I wasn't aware that he was working on election material.
For those of you who don't know Randall Ashbourne, was it Randall's idea to fill this chamber during the 97 election campaign with polystyrene cutouts with the faces of Dean Brown and John Olsen opposite?
Absolutely.
That was Randall's idea.
Every seat here was either John Olsen or Dean Brown, and it was about emphasising divisions.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a clever fellow. Have another question? We've got a few more minutes before we have... Yes, sir, you right up the bat. No.
I mean, who knows who was in Peter Lewis's office at any time of the day or night? There was bizarre goings on. I mean, there was always people going in and out, so I don't know.
Yeah. Another question? Just raise your hand. And then yes, sir, you.
That your use of the microphone, etc., is exceptional. But I am having trouble following the other two speakers,
so maybe
if you could be a little more attentive.
No, that's all right. It's all the good stuff's been me anyway. You haven't
missed anything, don't worry. Clem, did you have a question? No? I thought I saw a raised eyebrow. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Joe Scousey.
Well, I must say I agree with Mark. You just had to have lunch in the blue room to see how hard Randall Ashbourne was working for the Labor Party.
Yeah, well, he did work for the Labor Party, but...
Yes, yeah. But in...
But he also did quite a bit of freelancing. So.
Yeah. That...
Clearly.
It wasn't free for us.
No. Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we...
We promised to finish up by 7:45, and if there's... We've got time for a couple more questions, but I'm happy to wrap it up there, because I'm sure some of you, sometimes, you know, it's a big thing to stick your hand up and ask a question. Some of you might want to sidle up to Rob or Mike and ask privately, but...
Can I just say one thing I want to say. Happy birthday to Vinny. She's reached a very magic milestone today. And also I want to acknowledge, apart from the Treasurer and the Leader of the Opposition, Chris Sumner is here, who's just written a book. And it's a book that deserves to be read. It can be got online. And it tells the story of the last year of the Dunstan government, as well as things that happened before, better than I've ever seen. And it's massively researched. He spent a year on it. It also refutes a number of things that were in Peter Duncan's book. So strongly recommend Chris Sumner's book. And I'm trying to convince him to get the film rights.
Who's going to play Chris Sumner? Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your attendance tonight. I hope it's filled in a few gaps. And perhaps we can finish the night just by showing our appreciation of these two gentlemen.